Today on Wings, our exit interview with Dr. Perna Sen. In August 2020, Sen returned from New York to the UK after 5 years working for UN Women, first as policy director and then executive coordinator and spokesperson on sexual harassment and other forms of discrimination.
What does it mean? How does it happen? Who does it happen to? Who gets away with it? Why don't people talk about it?
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Perna Sen is a well-known global activist and scholar in the areas of women, gender, and human rights. Her doctoral thesis at the University of Bristol in England was titled A Basket of Resources, Women's Resistance to Domestic Violence in Calcutta. In the decades since, she's published in her field and worked with prominent institutions, including the London School of Economics, the Commonwealth Secretariat, and Amnesty International. In 2015, Sen was a Labour candidate for Parliament in the UK, and she spoke out about vicious online trolling. After losing to the incumbent, a woman from the Greens, she accepted the post of policy director at UN Women, and later focused in on harassment and discrimination. She talks about that work in this interview with Sheila Dallas Katzman.
Hello, everyone. I am Sheila Katzman, a reporter at Wings. Here with me today is Dr. Perna Sen, UN Women's Executive Coordinator and Spokesperson on Addressing Sexual Harassment and Other Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Welcome, Perna.
Sheila, thanks for having me.
Now, let me dive right into it. Everywhere I look on the UN site at your designation, attached to it are these words: works to advance the rights of victims, survivors of sexual harassment, wherever they are, and to promote the cultural change needed. Do you mind if we get into this a little?
Please go ahead.
Some may find the word victim troublesome. I do too. Some may say victims are dead. And how would you respond to them?
Yeah, thank you, Sheila. This is a common item of discussion, and one that I'm very happy to explain myself on. I want to acknowledge that the word victim has been a problematic label, particularly to women who've been abused or violated in some way. And it's been problematic because it denotes a particularly passive model of victimhood. It denies the person's humanity, and it reduces them to the violation which they suffered. And so I fully recognize why that's a very uncomfortable label in the way it has been used. I also recognize, though, that we talk about victims of crime. If you've been burgled, you're the victim of a burglary. If you were hit by a car, you can be called a victim of a car accident or a hit and run driver. And that notion of being wronged is something that I don't want to lose in the work we do to end violence. And it's been a long, hard struggle to get criminal recognition of violence done to women. So I also want those who work on aspects of criminal justice to incorporate, to recognize and hold on to the wrongs that are done to women, particularly around issues of violence and gender inequality. But I do want to recognize that women who deal with violence are creative, they manage, they cope, and they survive. Most, not enough, because like you say, some victims are dead, but most manage their way through an experience of violence and they survive it. So for me, I prefer to use the term victim survivor that tries to capture a bit of both of those.
Okay, thank you, Perna. Over the past couple of months, you've led a series of webinars addressing sexual harassment. The gambit was wide, from people with disability to the military and the police. So, can you give us a statement as to why these were particularly with the military and the police?
Yes, thank you, Sheila. The webinars series has been a very, very interesting line of work for me because it's not something I've done before. It was a new venture, and it started because the Commission on the Status of Women meeting this year was cancelled. We had lined up a lot of very interesting contributions from a variety of people and places, and we called it a discussion about leaving nobody behind, using the language of Agenda 23, which makes a very strong commitment, not only that nobody will be left behind, but those who have been furthest behind in the work that's been done all these decades are actually brought to the forefront of our minds. So we couldn't do that event because the Commission on the Status of Women meeting was cancelled. Nobody could travel. We couldn't meet in person at CSW. So we'd moved that event online, and we found it manageable in terms of organising it. And we found it to be an incredibly useful and valuable connection between people in different parts of the world. Unlike CSW, Sheila, nobody had to travel or pay an expensive plane fare or get a visa or pay a hotel bill in New York. It was a much more accessible way of having connections forged between us. So after that, we thought, actually, let's try this again. So we scheduled one more, which focused on training. How do we do effective training against sexual harassment? And then after that, okay, we can manage this. Let's line up a few more discussions. So we keep this issue on the public policy agenda. We keep and forge and deepen the connections between us across the world to galvanize each other, to share ideas, to think about strategy, to reflect on where we're up to and where the struggle against sexual harassment has got to. So that's why we picked quite a range of topics, some which we felt have inadequate attention in much of the global discussion, like disability and like those working in the informal sector, and others that I think just aren't adequately high in the recognition of where the problematics are. You mentioned the military and the police.
Was it only UN police, UN military, or the military and police at large in the world?
The focus wasn't and shouldn't ever be only on the UN. The UN should not be excluded, but the UN is part of the world that has to up its game. That conversation was really because there's a lot of interest in how it is that those to whom we turn for support in enforcing rules, and a lot of work around sexual harassment is about enforcement of rules, which is its own problematic. How is it when we turn to security personnel, to military, if we're talking about sexual exploitation and abuse, how is it that they are dealing with their own issues of sexual harassment at the same time they are trying to fix, as it were, the same problem in other organisations? What is it they've been able to do in organisations that are quite hierarchical and rigid in their structure to deal with an issue which is fundamentally, in our analysis, about inequality? So what I was saying was that the webinars have been a really valuable way to connect. And I think we've got the final figures today. It's something like over 1,500 people joined us across those different webinars. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah, that's amazing. Okay, so we're meeting because you're transitioning out of UN Women. You've worked in your capacity as the executive coordinator and spokesperson on addressing sexual harassment for the past 5 years. Am I right?
Not quite, Sheila. I took up this role. It was created in March 2018. Before that, I had been policy director at UN Women.
Brilliant. So during this time, how have you seen UN Women change?
Previously, my role was policy director, which meant we mostly focused on the world outside and what advice UN Women would give to support policy and practice change. The second role, the sexual harassment role, has had more inclusion of internal processes. And I would say that for most organizations which move sexual harassment up their priority agenda, it's always a journey of discomfort, of uncovering truths that have not been given attention, and of a journey towards a better place that may sometimes be contested. We would expect that because we would understand sexual harassment as an issue of inequality of power. So to disrupt those power dynamics is always going to be a tricky journey. So I think, like all organizations, UN Women has had to deal with that discomfort and think about how effectively to give life to the vision of its own leadership and of the UN leadership, which is an organization of zero tolerance of sexual harassment
It means we've had to think about what it is. What does it mean? How does it happen? Who does it happen to? Who gets away with it? Why don't people talk about it? Are they talking about it? And yes, Sheila, I think it's not only you and women, but I think over the last few years when Me Too and women's activists and non-activists across the world powerfully joined hands in this incredible global show of solidarity to create the first movement we've ever seen against sexual violence, the first global movement. I think this has created a very different set of conversations and possibilities, and it has profoundly changed the expectations of those who have always been landed with less power than, structurally less power than others, to say enough, to say we're not having this anymore, to say we expect people to be held accountable, we expect to go to work and school and college and parks and get on trains and buses without having to deal with this stuff. Those are dynamics that you see reflected in any organization dealing with it. Do we do training well? Does it have an impact? Are our policies what they should be? How do we change the beliefs that people bring into the workplace about how women are sexualized, how men have sexual access, which women are sexualized? Histories of colonialism and slavery, as we've written in our last publication, shape who is seen as appropriate for sexual aggression and who has excused that aggression. So I think we're in the midst of those conversations that need to continue, and because they are deep and to be lasting, they have to be deep.
And you think this will be accomplished? You know, the whole dynamics with dealing with diversity, inclusion, the power relations and all those sorts of things?
Sheila, what I think is possible is that those things can be done. Whether it happens or not is a question of political will, determination, staying in the journey for the long haul and not looking for easy gains and low-hanging fruit. I think they're about upsetting existing relationships of power and inequality. And let's be honest, the UN is a very hierarchical organization. You know, I've worked in universities, I've worked in other places. There are some organizations which are invested in systems of hierarchy and stars. And let me put inverted commas around stars. You know, they're big names, they're big players. And if the organization identifies itself with those, then it will be more likely to act in defense of those people rather than identifying itself with, let's say, the cleaners or the toilet cleaners or the junior staff or the interns, and less likely to ally intuitively with their interests. These are big cultural shifts you have to win. So what I see is that some of the steps that are necessary have been taken. Some conversations are opening in ways they didn't before. Those with least power are demanding change in ways they hadn't done before. There are reviews of how existing practices are conducive to sexual harassment either happening or not being addressed. But the proof of the pudding will be in whether or not this continues, whether those who are least powerful are able to shape that journey. If not, it's not going to work, Sheila. It's not going to happen. If women with disabilities aren't shaping the policy, if black women, if nationals versus international staff aren't part of this conversation, if young women aren't there saying, this is what it means to us, this is how we feel, when we're not treated, when we're not paid as interns, it's not going to happen if people with poor immigration issues and status, if they're not shaping it, then it's not going to happen, Sheila. And I hope the UN will live up to the values it espouses and expects of its member states in its own behavior. I think there's still a way to go.
On Wings, you're listening to Dr. Perna Sen, the founding executive coordinator and spokesperson on sexual harassment and other forms of discrimination for UN Women. The interviewer is Sheila Dallas Katzman.
I see your challenges already, and the challenges of UN Women and the UN at large. Now, what were your favorite moments at the UN?
I take heart and encouragement from a variety of different things. Sometimes it's the energy, the determination, the creativity of the women who've had the least power and influence historically who come together and feed off each other's commitment and creativity for change. I find that extremely uplifting and motivational and inspiring. So there are occasions where there have been some gatherings, sometimes at CSW, sometimes in other ways, that I have found very enriching. Sometimes it's about a very personal, intimate one-on-one conversation where somebody places their confidence in you and tells you something that matters to them and looks for your support to help them through. That's not about power for me. It's about solidarity. And it's a demand that you rise to the occasion and be there with them. Sometimes it's about little gains you get that which involve a huge amount of energy, like a phrase in a document that's agreed at CSW, the fighting you have every year on the same issues around LGBT rights or sexual health and reproductive rights. You know, we know the struggles that come up every year. Each time if we get a little gain, it feels to the outside world as so minimal, but we know it's a step in the right direction. So I don't know that I have one favorite, Sheila, but I think I have a type of favorite.
UN Women just turned 10, or it's turning 10. And I am thinking about obstacles.
Yes, you're right, Sheila. UN Women is just turning 10 this year. Obviously, the UN as a system is considerably older, into middle age, or if not older age by now. And it is the confluence of the actions and the politics of the states that make it up. Though I do want to remember and hold always in the forefront of my mind and our work that the UN Charter starts with the words, we the people. It is about the people. It is about citizens and non-citizens, about refugees and displaced, and about children and about disabled people with disabilities. And so I think you're bound to have reflected in an organization of this complexity that is the UN, and the politics that is inherent in relationships between states, you're bound to have some of that reflected in the substantive work that takes place. So it's no surprise that, say, for example, given how many reservations there have been to ratifications of CEDAW, that we're going to have discussions that involve member states that reflect those sorts of discomforts with the agenda for eliminating discrimination against women. Look, to be honest, I don't think we would get CEDAW now if it was up for discussion. We have an incredible document there, an incredible legal instrument that obliges certain actions and enforces monitoring and accountability. But the value of something at that high level to a woman who does home-based work in a rural village in Mongolia isn't the same as what her school, her community, her government does for her. So that distance has to be lessened. The language we use has to be more accessible. The processes, the meaning of laws has to be much more about everyday reality rather than documents invested and deposited at the UN in New York or Geneva. So I think there's a variety of obstacles. Some are political. Some are about having a variety of tactics and always anticipating rather than being caught by surprise that somebody objects to women getting equal pay. Well, we shouldn't be surprised. We shouldn't be surprised. And we should have a whole range of tactics in our toolbox to bring to those challenges. It's no surprise that we're going to have heated conversations, setbacks, hurdles to overcome when different states have different positions and those states are represented by governments of different politics.
The United States, under the Trump administration, has cut funding to the UN Health Organization, WHO. In what ways has the politics around the world affected the UN women?
It's absolutely true that a significant proportion of the resources for the UN come from a small number of states. And so any decisions by them to reallocate is going to be consequential. And that's an inevitability of the way it's structured. But I know that the relationship between the US and UN Women is not ruptured. I know that there are conversations about resourcing areas of work. It's not a conversation I'm personally involved in, there are other areas of interest of UN women's work that states who might object to certain areas of activity are comfortable with. You know, these things are always more complicated than they seem. But I think we also need to be very, very clear and steadfast in our commitment to the values and the agendas that our mandate at the agency and as the UN as a whole, we are obliged to deliver. We have promised, we are obligated to realize the rights that have been promised in CEDAW, sorry, I shouldn't use acronyms, conventions and laws that promise equality for women, for those with disabilities, for against racial discrimination, for civil and political and economic and social rights. These are not negotiable. I think the struggle for women's liberation, freedom from oppression, freedom from racial inequality, has always been a struggle of challenge and contestation. And we are not neutral, and we cannot be neutral in the pursuit of those promises.
So in those regards, what has COVID-19 meant for the organization and for the work you do around sexual harassment?
COVID-19 has been a massive shock, obviously, to the whole world, and a terrible, terrible tragedy for too many millions of people. And we also see more and more, as data becomes available, the disproportionate and unequal impact it has had on different groups of people. We have to hold that in mind alongside general tragedy and loss of life that we witness. Secondly, COVID has led to a reprioritization and reconsideration of where multilateral funds should be used. Just as what was called a refugee crisis in Europe a few years ago, that prompted a reconsideration of where money was going, and that had impact on multilateral work because some states wanted to keep the money for their work within their national boundaries or within their region. And that also had impacts on what was happening at a multilateral level. So in some ways, these are going to happen periodically. For COVID, I think because it's been so far reaching in terms of how we work, what we do at home, what we do with our leisure time, who we can talk to, it's going to require us to rethink how we live and how we work and how we study. I personally don't think that's all a bad thing. I don't want us to go back to how it used to be, because how it used to be didn't work for women, it didn't work for minorities, it didn't work for people with disabilities, it didn't work for refugees. I hope that out of the tragedy of COVID, we sustain and deepen our strategies about building a world that works. So let's make sure that the world we build, we create, we shape out of the pandemic is one that works better for women, because it hasn't worked well for them so far.
Do you think the Me Too campaign hindered or helped?
Absolutely helped. I am really heartened that domestic violence rose up the public policy agenda during a time of the pandemic and the imposition of lockdown in so many places. It's a recognition I don't think we would have got 20 years ago. I think something has shifted in policy conversations that recognizes violence against women in more effective ways than historically. And that is very much a testimony to the activism, the scholarship, the research, and the determination of women to make sure it's on the public policy agenda. What I do think is a problem is that other forms of violence and abuse have not had adequate recognition during this time. And so, you know, child marriage has continued, sexual harassment has continued, child abuse has continued. Yet we could, the list is far too long. And if we take our eye off the ball and we allow certain areas of work to drop from our public policy agenda, we risk not getting it back, because it's very hard to get there in the first place. And if it falls off, you know, we risk losing it. So I think, you know, part of our webinar series was looking at sexual harassment during the pandemic and capturing some experiences from the health and domestic workers groups about what's happening for them. Me Too, I think the movement has been absolutely crucial to the fact that sexual harassment is on a global discussion policy agenda in ways it never has been before. It really hasn't been there. There's hardly any politician or policymaker or legislator in the world who can say now they don't know what sexual harassment is, or they don't know that it happens, or that they will excuse it. It just isn't possible. It's just, you know, it will be the minority of people, and they will perhaps be ridiculed, or they will certainly be taken up by others. it won't be so easy to get away by saying, doesn't happen, or I don't know what you're talking about. And it's the movement that did that. The movement did that on the legacy and on the backs of all the work that was done before that. It didn't come out of nowhere. It built upon the foundations laid on decades of work in all over the world before that. But it has profoundly shifted, I think, in a way that hadn't happened before. The urgency, recognition of intolerance of the existing, of status quo, calls for accountability and justice, and a demand for not only the end of sexual harassment and its links to other violence, but also saying, don't even let it happen. Don't make us wait and call for accountability and justice. We don't want this to happen. This is not an inevitability the way our mothers told us it was for them. We're not having it anymore. I think that is a massive thing that has changed because of the movement.
Okay. We want to know, what will Herna Sen do next?
Sheila, what Herna's going to do first is take a little breather. The last 2.5 years have been really, really frantically busy and, you know, very rewarding. I'm very happy to be busy. I do need just to stop and take a breather briefly. I have decided, therefore, not to go into a full-time job straight away. I have a few projects that I'm going to be throwing myself into, and I'll say a little bit more about that in a few weeks' time. But it's very, I think this is a very exciting time, Sheila. I think Me Too has really been such a phenomenal organization, not like a structure, but a movement. It prompts us to rethink what we're doing. I also think that alongside that particular struggle for justice is the reawakening of struggles for racial justice. And they come together, they have the potential to come together to do something really amazing in the world. To join different struggles for justice together is a powerful thing. I hope that this is a time where those sorts of strands, which have been parallel for very much of our shared history, you know, struggle for justice here versus a struggle for justice there, I hope it allows us to come together more. And I want to be part of that collective effort, whether it will be as an academic again, or a policymaker, or a troublemaker. I'm perfectly open. I think our work around what I call building a world that works for women is about working together across our different disciplines and our specialisms and our strengths. And I'm leaving UN Women, but I'm not leaving the work or the struggle. I will continue. You know, I've done it before, did it for 30 years before I came to UN Women, and I will keep doing it after.
That was Dr. Herna Sen speaking August 26, 2020, with Sheila Dallas-Katzman, president of the U.S. chapter of the International Association of Women in Radio and Television. To hear Wings programs again, email wings@wings.org or visit our website wingsradio.org/WordPress. Wings thanks our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose writings and videos can be found on the website gifteconomy.com. That's gift-economy.com. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle Is Cast. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.